Hi again, folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and we're here once again to talk about all things related to the world's second biggest property investment market, Japan. Our last episode, which was subtitled Decisions, Decisions, was all about the choices facing people in the market for ski holiday homes. It seems to have struck a chord with many of you based on download numbers and the messages that we've been receiving this week. So for this week's episode, we've decided to carry on with the same format, which is a recording of a business call with clients who are trying to make up their minds and make some decisions on how to approach certain topics related to the property market here in Japan. So this time we're on the phone with a couple from Singapore who are faced with all of the tip decisions that are facing first-time investors entering this arena for the very first time. So stuff we've discussed here in the past on many occasions, buildings versus condo units, high-yield second-tier towns versus first-tier metropolitan centers with slightly lower yields, even north versus south, cash versus financing, etc., etc. So again, you'll probably hear us bring up many of the topics that we were already discussing here on the podcast over the last couple of years. But I think it's a really good chance to see how these topics all tie together and also how all of these big and small decisions can dictate the performance of our investment portfolios over time. So some of these things may run counterintuitive to what many of us take for granted in our countries of origin. So worth noting again as well, just to ensure that we're aware of the differences between Japan and other property markets around the world. So here it is, a recording of a business call with a client from Singapore about to enter the Japanese real estate property investment arena for the very first time. Enjoy and see you on the other side.
I think this is the first time we're looking into Japan. And I've done some reading and, based on what I've read, the returns or the yield seems to be quite attractive. The only thing we also understand is that, probably loan is going to be an issue.
To a point. I mean, there are some solutions available depending on what you're buying, but it's really more a matter of whether it's going to be worth it. So depending on the portfolio size that you have got planned, you might have to set up a Japanese or Hong Kong company for that purpose. And that comes with setup costs and monthly upkeep costs, and it changes your tax scenarios a little bit as well. So it really depends on what sort of properties and what kind of budget you're talking about.
Right. I guess it's a chicken and egg thing. It's like, if it is without load, then it's something comfortable, then, it will probably be something like a couple of hundred thousand only. But if we can get loan, then, we can look at something much bigger. You know what I'm trying to say?
So, yeah.
So, because if I look at some of the offerings, even in whatever US term or Singapore term, a couple of hundred thousand, we can get something quite easily, but
that's correct. So your cash so your cash capital outlay is a few hundred thousand dollars, and if you're getting financing, then depending on what the loan to value ratio is, you might go up to I guess loans are usually up to 75%, so you might get something up to say 1 million roughly. Is that about right?
Yeah 1 million.
Yeah, we are comfortable with 60-40 sort of arrangement even anyway.
Okay. Well, let's discuss your other criteria first, and then we'll get back to the loan issue and see if that satisfies their criteria as well.
Other criteria, probably, things that are easy to rent out, which I suppose transportation is important, I mean, we've been to Japan a couple of times, so as near as possible to the train station. What else?
We're talking only about Tokyo, right?
Well, it could be completely up to you. Yeah. Yields are quite low in Tokyo.
Major commercial center like Tokyo, Osaka, maybe Fukuoka, one of those major cities.
And growth city, yeah.
Yeah, so if we're focusing on major commercial centers and places that are growing population-wise, that would be Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, Nagoya, and Fukuoka mainly.
Right.
There are some other smaller cities that are regional centers and have got good industries and good commercial profiles, like Kumamoto and some of the satellite cities around Tokyo and Osaka. So places like Kobe, Kawasaki, Chiba City, Saitama. Yeah, yeah. But these places are usually characterized with less potential growth. So if the economy does well in Japan, the first tier cities that we've mentioned, so Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka, Nagoya, Fukuoka, they all stand to grow if Japan's economy does well. Whereas with the other places, we can get high yields there, but that's mainly because they haven't grown in price, or they haven't grown much in price.
The price hasn't moved that much.
That's not much. So first of all, well, first things first, talking about rental income, so rental income in Japan hasn't grown significantly at all over the course of the last decade or two decades. It's actually, since the bubble burst in the early 90s, rents have actually dropped. And since 2012 or so, when things started improving again, the rents have been, aside from very central Tokyo and Osaka and Fukuoka, rents have been pretty stagnant. So they might have risen slightly, but not nearly as much as property prices.
Right. Okay. So the yield has been compressing.
That's right. So the reason for that is mainly a trickle-down effect that hasn't been happening. So economically, on the macro level, things have improved, or at least look like they're improving. That's, you know, that's a cause for endless debate. But that hasn't trickled down to salaries. And because salaries haven't improved and there have actually been two consumption tax hikes, cost of living has also been cost of living has been growing and salaries haven't been growing, which means that we can't really raise rents anywhere.
Right.
And that's the reason that you see the places that have done well as far as property prices are concerned, which is Tokyo and Osaka mainly, and then next in line, Kyoto, Nagoya, and Fukuoka. Those places have had their yields compressed. So in Tokyo and Osaka, it's gotten pretty close to pre-bubble days. I mean, yields are very low and prices are quite high. Nagoya, Kyoto, and Osaka, Nagoya, Kyoto, and Fukuoka still have room to grow price-wise.
Right.
And therefore, yields there are still relatively higher compared to Tokyo and Osaka. So those places are not near bubble terms, probably won't be. But still less than what they were before. So in Nagoya and Fukuoka, for example, we could have gotten, say, 11, 12 net pre-tax up to about 3-4 years ago. These days, if we get 7 or 8, we're very happy.
Right.
And in
so
Tokyo,
now it's about 7 and 8. Okay.
Best case scenario. So in Tokyo and Osaka, the best case scenario is usually about 4 or 5. And in those other cities, maybe 7 or 8 if we're lucky. And that's just so we're on the same page, that's net pre-tax. So including all of your purchase and all of the known running monthly costs, but not including annual taxes and not including anything that we can't predict in advance, like vacancies or maintenance and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so the net will be something, again, down to maybe another 2 points down or 2%
down? Yeah, I mean, again, that really depends on the size of your portfolio and whether you need to hire an accountant services, and also whether you've purchased relatively older or newer buildings which require more or less maintenance. So it could go down anywhere, I'd say, from a further 1 to 3% if you want to look at net-net.
Right.
So if you're talking about a few hundred thousand dollars and you're looking for the highest yield possible, you're probably, I'm guessing, looking at individual units and not entire buildings, because with entire buildings, the yield does tend to be a bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you're purchasing cash, we haven't talked about the loan yet, but if you're purchasing cash, then you really don't want to be purchasing any building that costs less than, say, $400,000, because these would be either very old or in out-of-the-way places.
Right.
So if you're talking about $100,000 or $200,000, you're probably better off buying individual units.
Individual units, I see.
Yes.
Okay.
You can go for houses if you want, but houses carry a lot of maintenance costs compared with condo units. So, again, it's up to you.
Understand. Individual units, yeah. I guess, yeah. If we, if if you are not looking into a million or so, you can buy a building with a few units. Yeah.
You can. I mean, buildings in good locations that are not too old would usually start about maybe lowest possible would be 350,000. Like, for example, we've got a few customers who have purchased in Fukuoka in quite good locations and, you know, buildings that have built, say, in the last 10 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And these do start, if we're talking about a 4, 6, 8 unit block, these do start at about $350,000, $400,000.
Okay.
So small residential buildings, maybe with some of them with, you know, a shop or an office at the ground level sort of thing.
Right, right. So actually, in your opinion, is it good to buy and build and hold a building like 4 to 8 units or buy units all over the places?
Well, there are advantages and disadvantages.
The highest yield, you know. Yep.
There are advantages and disadvantages to both. I guess to make a recommendation, we'd need to know, are you invested in any other types of properties in any other places in the world? Or what's your portfolio, investment portfolio look like at the moment?
Singapore?
Anywhere.
Singapore and New Zealand, where we are now.
So that's very low yield, I'm guessing, but capital growth has been good, yes?
Yeah, Singapore, capital growth has been good. Yield is very compressed. New Zealand too, now the yield is very compressed. Yeah, but when we first came in, yeah, the yield were not so bad. Yep.
So that means your property price have also gone up, yes?
Yep, they have gone up a bit. Yeah.
Okay.
So but why we started to look into Japan is that, you know, my husband works now with a Japanese company, so he's gone to Japan more often, and suddenly it dawned on us that the yield were fantastic. Probably we should have gone in much earlier, but yeah, we just saw.
Well, if
the
you're
yield
aiming,
looks very attractive. Yeah.
Well, if your main criteria is the highest possible yield or cash flow, and you've got investments in other places that are more capital growth oriented, like New Zealand and Singapore. Then individual units are probably better in the sense that they will generate a higher yield. The disadvantages are, first and foremost, they don't stand to grow as much as an entire building stands to grow, simply because they come with a tiny land parcel for each unit and not a big one like a building.
Right.
What gains in value is basically the land. It's not going to be the structures. So
right.
The larger the land parcel, the more of a potential capital growth you've got. So when you're buying individual units, they do grow in price, but they don't grow as sharply as buildings in the same locations.
Understand.
And the other disadvantage is that they're less flexible with use. So you're dependent on owner co-op rule books and building management rules and bylaws. So, for example, some buildings will not allow to use units as an office. So that limits your tenant base a little bit. You can only go residential. Almost 100% of the units, of the condo units in Japan, the building will not allow short-term use, like Airbnb type. Whereas if you own the entire structure, you pretty much set the rules. I mean, you still have to comply with government regulations, but there's nobody else telling you what to do with your particular units in that building.
Understand.
And the advantages are, that there's usually less maintenance and unexpected expenses incurred, because your monthly fees usually cover all structural expenses and all communal areas. Whereas if you own the entire building, everything's on you. So something happens to the exterior, you need to find money out of your own pocket to pay for it. The other advantage, I guess, is that if you divide your capital between, a larger amount of cheaper properties, then you just get more diversity and hedging, of course.
My husband was just asking, how about commercial
in the sense of commercial buildings, or are we talking about offices and shops and restaurants and bars or logistics?
Yeah.
I mean, commercials usually start at a slightly higher price tag. So you could find maybe a shop or a restaurant or a bar, that sort of thing within that budget. But if you're looking at an entire building, that'll usually be more than $100,000 or $200,000.
Yeah, I understand.
And then...
No, I'm just thinking more on the shops and those things, but I'm not sure whether, you know, the demand is there, because if you drive around Tokyo, there seems to be some, especially on the outskirts, there seems to be quite a bit of, you know, vacant sort of shops around.
Well, that applies to residential as well. You just don't see it.
Yeah.
I mean, the further you get...
Because they're upstairs, you can't see them.
Yeah, I mean, the further you get from the center of the city, the more vacant properties you'll see. And, you know, as the population declines, unless something is done to reverse that, as the population declines, the outer cities are slowly conglomerating into the bigger cities. I mean, of the cities that we've discussed, except for Fukuoka, which has got organic growth, I mean, people are actually having babies, the rest of the places are only growing because there's smaller cities conglomerating into them, right? So Tokyo and Osaka.
Foreigners.
Foreigners, unfortunately, still not that much. So, commercial-wise, the advantage of commercial, I suppose, is that you can raise the rent if the economy does well a lot more than you can with residential. If it's doing well and you raise the rent, they'll want to stay in that same place and they're going to pay it. With residential, we can't do that. So as long as people's salaries haven't gone up again, we can't raise the rent. So with commercial, you've got more flexibility as far as rent is concerned. But that also means that when the economy doesn't do that well, they tend to move out and close shop and resize a lot more than residential tenants do. I mean, a residential tenant is not going to move out because the economy is not doing well, but a business might. So you got more tenant turnover statistically. I mean, you could get lucky, you could get unlucky, but statistically you got more tenant turnover. And if you've got a place with walk-in traffic, like a shop, and definitely with a restaurant or a bar, then there tend to be a lot more maintenance and renovations involved when a tenant does move out.
Right, understand.
Yeah, and also again, the price tag starts a little bit higher. I guess maybe the best of both worlds is to buy a unit in a condo block that's designated multi-purpose. So if the building rule book allows it, that can be rented out as an office space or a residential space.
Right.
And then your tenant base
You mean they have such a thing, multi-purpose building?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I mean, a lot of accountants and legal offices and places like us, like we also, our office is in a building like that, which is about 50% residential, 50% commercial. Not commercial in the sense of, there's not walk-in traffic. There's not people just coming in off the street, but people make appointments. They come into the office. That's very doable here.
Right. Where are you? You are in Tokyo itself, right?
Fukuoka.
Your office?
Fukuoka.
Oh, you are in Fukuoka?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we must visit Fukuoka.
Yeah.
Is it booming now? It's booming, eh?
It's a fantastic city. I mean, like I said, it's one of the only places in Japan that's growing organically, where people are actually having babies. The population is quite young and modern here, so there's more tenant turnover, but we very rarely have a problem to find tenants for properties here. When we started, actually, most of our business was in Fukuoka City. These days, again, yields have been compressed, so anyone who's looking for more than 7 or 8% tends to go to other places like Sapporo or Kumamoto.
Sapporo, that is Hokkaido.
Yes. So Sapporo prices haven't gone up. It's a very big city, about 2 million people, or big Japan in Japan standards. Prices haven't gone up significantly, so returns there can still get to 8, 9%.
Right.
The problem with Sapporo
is... Sapporo is also not a growing, but is...
It's not growing, no. The population is stable or in slightly declining. And the other problem with Sapporo is because it's a winter, it snows there for about half the year. And during the snowy months, for one, tenants don't tend to move around as much. So if you get a vacancy close to winter, you might be vacant for 6, 7, 8 months.
Understand.
And the other thing is that maintenance costs are also higher there. So just, again, because of the winter and the snow, you have to pay more for heating equipment. Pipes tend to freeze and break down more frequently. So those high yields that we get at the time of purchase might not really be valid on the longer term.
Right. understand.
On the upside, it's more of an old school city with a little bit of an older population, so people don't move around as much. So tenant turnover is quite low there, and you do have a lot of places where people have been living for decades, which is something that we don't get much in Fukuoka.
Right, right. So in that sense, it's stability in one way. If you have tenants there, they likely will stay there for very long.
Yes. Also, because they've got more room to build there, properties tend to be bigger. So even, I mean, in most of the bigger cities, the highest yielding properties are usually studio or one bedroom apartments.
Right.
And they have, obviously, they'll have a single tenant or maybe a couple without any children or a single mom with one child.
Mm-hmm.
In Sapporo, for the same sort of yield, we can actually get bigger properties that might be family sized.
Right.
And then family tenants tend to stay a lot longer than couples or singles.
Right, right.
So it's a more stable...
You can value add and change them.
Yeah, I mean, so it's a more stable, it's a lot slower, the mentality there. But it's also, when you do have a vacancy or when something does break down, it can be longer and it can cost more.
Okay, that's good to know. So coming back, when we talk about loans, how do we position ourselves if we were looking to get something that has loan, or we should start just small first and see how it grows?
Well, the loan criteria, I mean, first of all, let's discuss loans for people like yourselves who are non-residents and don't have any presence in Japan and so forth. So for you guys in your current situation, a loan would have to be either in Tokyo or Kanagawa, Osaka, Kyoto, and places like Nagoya or Fukuoka is subject to approval, so depending on whether the bank will approve it or not.
Right.
You have to set up a... Do you happen to have Hong Kong residency?
No, we don't have Hong Kong residency.
Okay, so then you'll have to you'll have to go for a Japanese lender, which means you'll have to set up a Japanese company structure.
Uh-huh, okay. And
that costs about $3,000 or $4,000 to set up.
Okay.
The mortgage broker charges, these costs are all only payable if the loan is approved in principle. So you don't have to pay anything beforehand, and then you can pay that from the loan amount. From the loan amount that you receive. So it's not out of pocket, but it does need to be paid when the loan is approved.
Right.
And then the mortgage broker charges, I think, $2,000 to set up the loan, or $1,500 or $2,000 US to set up the loan. And the bank charges a 2% setup cost.
Okay.
And then
the bank setup cost is about 2%, okay.
Yeah. And then they'll only approve loans for those particular locations. They'll want buildings that will have not been beyond 25 years at loan maturity. So you have to aim for younger buildings.
Right. So not more than 20 when the loan matures, okay.
More not beyond 25 years, yes. And the other thing is, it's got to be purely residential. So if you're purchasing properties that have got any short-term rentals or commercial rentals or even monthly leases as opposed to long-term leases, the bank will not approve the loan until all of the tenants in the property are on long-term residential leases.
Understand.
And the last thing is that if you're purchasing in Fukuoka and potentially in Nagoya as well, the bank will force you to use their designated property managers, which tend to cost a little bit more because it's some of the bigger companies that are nationwide. So they tend to cost a little bit more than the local property managers that, for example, we would normally appoint. And also, if you're unhappy with the property manager for any reason, you might be able to replace them, but only with another designated one that the bank appoints. And then the LTV ratio is up to 70 or 75% from memory. So you have to put in 25 or 30% in cash.
Right.
And the interest is somewhere between 3.2 to 4%, depending on the loan and the lender.
So the loan interest is also higher, 3.2 to 4%.
Well, higher compared to a Japanese entity which has been established and generating income for a while.
Understand.
So the other thing that a lot of people...
So does it...
Sorry, go for it.
Why don't you complete what you want to say? The other thing...
Well, the other thing that some people do is they first purchase some properties in cash and they generate a local Japanese income for, say, 5 or 6 years.
Right.
Or they set up a company
Then go for this.
Yeah, they set up a company regardless of the loan, and they set up, for example, an asset management company, and they buy one building and put it under the company name. So the building is the asset manager for that building. The company is the asset manager for that building. And then after they've established 5 or 6 or 7 years of income, then they're a normal Japanese entity and they can apply for any Japanese bank for a loan, which is, you know, the criteria becomes a lot easier.
Understand. Okay, but what's the catch when you have it as a Japanese company structure? So you pay Japanese tax, right, basically?
Well, you always pay Japanese tax. You always pay Japanese tax now.
Yeah.
You can't,
So
Singapore and Japan have got a tax treaty in place, and that means that you'll first get taxed in Japan, and then any difference in the tax rates you'll have to pay back home.
Right.
So you're not going to be paying double the taxes. With Japanese companies, if you're looking at assets that are about $1 million or over that, then the corporate tax is actually lower than individual tax. But up until that point, corporate tax is capped. So... tax-wise, it does make more sense for the budget that you were discussing so far, $100,000 or $200,000. Tax-wise, it does make more sense to purchase as individuals.
Right.
And also company...
So for companies, more $1 million and above, then it's worth
When the individual tax will go over 20 or 30% from memory, which is when it makes sense to cap it at the 20, 30% the corporate tax that you get. But the other thing is that accounting and bookkeeping cost a lot more for companies than they do for individuals as well.
Right.
So really the only reason for you to set up a company is one of two reasons. One is if you think that you're going to be looking at total assets worth, say, $1 million US or more, then it does make sense tax-wise, or if you need the company structures because you're applying for a loan or for a visa or something of that sort.
Right. Or loan or visa. Okay. If not, it's more costly,
Otherwise, it'll definitely cost more. And there's also, to set up the company structure itself costs about, I'd say at a minimum, probably $4,000.
Yeah, understand. Okay, good. We've covered lot of things. It give us some idea. So the next question is how do we start, how do we go from here?
Well, I guess the first thing is we're probably going to just exchange a few emails so we can set down criteria more clearly and we know exactly what we're looking for. And then we'll send you engagement forms, which you'll need to sign and have witnessed by a notary public or a lawyer or a chartered accountant or somebody with like an official looking stamp, which is what they like to see here in Japan.
Okay.
And then that enables us to contact realtors and sellers, et cetera, on your behalf and represent you here. And then if you actually want to start submitting offers on any particular property, we need our fee estimate paid in advance based on your budget.
Mm-hmm.
And then post-settlement, we'll credit or debit you according to what the actual purchase price ended up being. And that fee estimate represents you until you settle. So you can submit, 100 offers. We're not going to charge you anything extra for that. So it's one fee estimate per one settlement.
Okay. Coming back, what about bank account? For example, if we are not going for the company structure and we're going for the single ownership structure or individual structure, do we need to set up a bank there, or how do money get transferred back or something like that?
It would be good if you could, but unfortunately, that's not an option for non-residents.
Okay.
And some of the international banks offer what they call foreign investor accounts or foreign or non-resident accounts, but these are not really practical for these lower rental incomes because they charge you about $50 per transaction or something. And they'll always want you to keep worth of money in the account for them to be able to. So, well, for the same monthly fee that we charge for managing the portfolio, we also include financial management. So we collect the rental income, we do a periodical income and expenses statement, and then whenever you want to remit funds back home, you just let us know and we send them to you.
Right. Okay. So when we buy through you, you could also help us manage the property?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So you would... I mean, after this email, if you could put that down so that we know the charges, so we know we got to pay you, you know, to buy, and then as our representative, and then as a management, how much is the fee, so that, you know, we've got all this thing.
Yeah, so I'll send you a document that we call explanation of services, and that includes all of those fees. That applies for standard long-term leases. If you're going to end up doing monthly leases, it changes a little bit. But I mean, we'll get to that if you'll need to do that. But just to give you a rough idea, so we're an added layer on top of realtors and property managers. So we work with the real estate agents and we work with the property management companies and we interact with the building management companies and the insurance companies and all of that. So we're like your single point of contact or portfolio manager after the purchase.
Right.
And then our fees are, depending on your budget, per property, somewhere between 3-5%, depending on the property price. And
okay.
For the monthly management, it's between 2-3%, again, depending on the price of the property.
Okay.
But we like to think, and you can talk to some of our customers to confirm that we justify that cost, not just by giving you the management, but we can also negotiate better prices. We can also work with agents that we know and provide full disclosure on every property, and we also provide constant advice to help you just not to make any costly mistakes. So I think you'll find that those fees more than cover themselves.
Okay. So just let me clarify, for your service to help us negotiate and buy the property is about 3-3.5% of the property price. And on top of that, do we still have to pay the agent?
Yeah.
The buying agent.
Yeah, so
that's the fee.
The total cost breakdown is like that. So depending on the property price, again, if you're buying very cheap properties, like let's say an older studio unit that's costing, say, 30 or 40,000 US, then the realtor fee is going to be closer to 4.5-5%.
Okay.
Our fee as well will be about 5%.
Right.
And then there's a purchase tax, which varies depending on the official evaluation, but it's probably safe to assume about 2.5%.
Right.
And legal and registration costs, which are, again, depending on official evaluation, and they're lower when the property is more expensive, but could be anywhere from 3-8%.
Okay.
So for very cheap properties that are valued very highly because prices have gone down in that particular location, for example, it could be closer to 8%. And, you know, properties that are pricier and the official eval still hasn't caught up because the market, like Fukuoka, for example, for 2 or 3 years were evaluated a lot lower than it actually was market price-wise. So those kinds of places, it might be closer to 3%. So again, it depends on the property and the official evaluation.
I understand.
When we send you Excel sheets to analyze deals and try to ascertain whether you're happy with the numbers or not, we always assume a worst-case scenario for purchase costs and running costs.
Mm-hmm.
So worst case, we like to assume 20% purchase costs. Usually by settlement, depending on the price of the property, it's going to be anywhere from 12-17% purchase cost.
Right.
But we just like to look at a worst case scenario so that by settlement it can only improve.
Right. Okay. So at least we factor in about 20% worst case scenario for the cheaper properties.
I mean, if we're going to be aiming for anything that's, say, over 5 million yen to begin with, like properties that cost 45,000 US and upwards per unit, then it's probably going to be more like 18% worst case. So we'll adjust that depending on the property we're looking at.
Understand. Okay. But really, we can get something for $30,000 US dollars?
Yeah, absolutely.
Over there.
Not probably, definitely not in Tokyo and Osaka. And it's getting harder in Nagoya and Fukuoka as well. But in other places, that's still, Sapporo, Kumamoto, sometimes on the outskirts of Kobe, that's still very doable.
Okay. Wow. Okay. It's just, that's why I'm saying that we never realized that you can do that. It's like the price of a car, really.
Yeah, I know. The market's gone through 2 decades of deflation here. So.
Understand.
There are still very cheap places, and definitely compared to Singapore. But again, nicer places, more central locations, higher prices, lower yields, but it's worth it because it's much more stable tenancies, and obviously the newer the place is, the less maintenance you're going to pay. So, it's just a matter of striking. Yeah, strike a balance that's right for you, that's all.
Good. Okay, so anything else that I need to know, or then before you send me your thing, and I could get back to you. But like I say, I'm traveling. I probably could only get back when documents to sign and all that. Probably end of next week. I'm only back to Singapore 2nd of December.
No, that's fine. Take your time. There's no rush from our side. I guess anything else that you need to know. Well, not generally. We'll talk a lot about specific locations and specific property profiles when we start looking at individual deals. But generally, I think that's probably about it.
Okay. I think we covered up. Yep.
All right.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Zeth.
I'll send you those documents and the explanation of services. Just have a read of that. That might bring up some more questions that you might want to ask.
Okay. Yep. All right. We speak soon again.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Have a good day.
Take care. Bye.
You too. So there you have it. Again, nothing we have not discussed here in the past, but it is good to put these things into context and see how they can affect performance of investment portfolios over time. And also, like in the case of, say, a finance purchase versus a cash purchase or a property designated for monthly rentals as well as potential long-term leases, some of these decisions that we'll be making will also dictate the property profile that we'll be aiming for in the first place, whether it's the location, the size, the age, or even the layout of the property. And all of that, of course, also dictates the purchase budget. And vice versa, if we know we have a maximum budget or a minimum yield ceiling, that will, by default, then dictate our strategy accordingly, because we'll only be able to aim for particular property profiles that may or may not be applicable with one or more particular strategies. So that's it from us for today, folks. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. As always, do feel free to leave your comments, your questions, or requests for more information or more episodes of a particular type in the comments section of wherever you might have found this episode. If you haven't done so yet, we'd really appreciate it if you could share this podcast with your network, and even better, if you could leave us a star rating or even a short review in the iTunes Store, the Spotify app, or anywhere that good podcasts can be found and rated. Your opinion not only matters to us, but it also helps us reach more listeners who may benefit from this content, which is, of course, a win-win situation for everyone involved. We hope to have you with us next time, so do subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already. And until then, from all of us here at NTI, we wish you a fantastic week or weekend, day or night, wherever in the world you may be tuning in from and whichever time you happen to be listening to us at. And until we meet again, happy home hunting.